series on our Advent series, which we are calling This Changes Everything. And what we're doing in this series, as we've said, is we're showing how the coming of Jesus into history created a turning point, a hinge, if you will, in which after he came, nothing was the same again. And so it changed everything, and we're giving a couple examples of things that it changed. So for instance, 2 weeks ago, I talked about how Jesus' coming changed the way that we view family, the way that we view church. We are brothers and sisters, and that makes a difference for how we help out those in financial crisis. Today, what I want to show you is that the coming of Jesus changes the issue of truth. What is truth? How do we know truth? All those types of things. This is a big picture message that comes right into so many of the cultural issues that we face today. Parker Palmer wrote a book entitled A Hidden Wholeness. And in this book, he tells some really interesting stories. He tells about how farmers in the Midwestern United States have to prepare when a blizzard is coming. So I know we live in Victoria. Do you know what a blizzard is? No, I'm not talking Dairy Queen, right? I'm talking about like snow, like lots of it, like way more than you've seen in Victoria ever. So much snow that farmers, they would have to prepare for the blizzard. And one thing that they would do is that they would take a rope and they would tie it to the doorknob of the house and they would run it all across their huge yards and property all the way out to their barn door, and then they would tie it to the barn door. And the reason they do this is because just because there's a blizzard going on doesn't mean a farmer just gets to sit in by his nice warm fire and wait for the whole thing to pass. A farmer still has to care for his animals. A farmer still has to go out to the barn. But the problem is, if you go out into a blizzard, you enter into a complete whiteout. You can't see anything. It's like being inside of a ping pong ball. And the farmer can hardly see his own hand in front of his face. And so what would often happen, there's all kinds of terrible stories of this, is farmers would become disoriented. They would become confused. They would start going around in circles on their own property, thinking that they were heading straight for their barn when they weren't. And so they would become disoriented, confused, and many would even freeze to death right in their own backyards. And so what farmers would do is they would tie this rope from the house to the barn so that as they left the house, they could just simply hold on to the rope. It would guide them all the way to the barn. And then when they're done caring for their animals, they could come back. It would guide them safely on their journey home. I think this is a great metaphor for the kind of culture that we live in. We live in a culture where we become disoriented and confused, where truth is lost in a blizzard of opinions. This has been particularly poignant this last year in 2017, hasn't it? The issue of truth. What is truth? Can we know truth? It's so confusing so much of the time. And of course, one of the major catalysts to this was the inauguration of Donald Trump as president. So since he came into office, this has been at the forefront of our conversation. We now talk about things like fake news. We talk about things like alternative facts. We're a whole culture who are struggling so much with this entire issue of truth. Time magazine picked up on this. Those of you who can remember back to the 1960s, Time magazine put out a very famous cover dealing with one of the most important issues in the whole of the world, and they asked this question: is God dead? That was the front cover of Time magazine in the 60s, a critical issue. Picking up on that exact critical stuff, that critical nature, back in April, Time magazine took the same font, the same design, and they put out this cover in April: is truth dead? That's the questions we're wrestling with as a culture. Can we even know what truth is? Is there such thing anymore? Can we even discern what it is? Can we even figure out what we need to think about important issues in life? This blizzard of opinions then, it leaves us disoriented, it leaves us confused, it leaves us wandering around in circles. Let me give you some examples. Listen to this quote from a Harvard graduate on his graduation day. Quote, "Among my classmates, however, I believe that there is one idea, one sentiment, which we have all acquired at some point in our Harvard careers. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is in a word, confusion." So you've gone to Harvard, And what you come away with is confusion. Why is that? Here's what another Harvard student said in elaborating, quote, "They tell us it's heresy to suggest the superiority of some value. It's fantasy to believe in moral argument. It's slavery to submit to a judgment sounder than your own. The freedom of our day is the freedom to devote yourself to any values we please on the mere condition that we do not believe them to be true." You see where the confusion comes in. So our culture is always telling this. You may believe whatever you like. You can believe the tree is God. You can believe you're a God. Whatever you want to believe, you can believe it. Just don't go saying that what you believe is true is also true for everybody else. It's your own private truth that you have. So this is very confusing, though, because if something's true, it isn't not all things are this way. I mean, it's true for me that I really like Reese's Pieces, Krispy Kreme, Blizzards, a Dairy Queen. That might not be true for you. That kind of truth is a different level. But there's a whole bunch of other truth that when you talk about that kind of truth, isn't it true for everyone? If it's true for me, like it's wrong to murder somebody, it's just not my private truth. Isn't it true for everyone at all times and all places? But how can you know what's true? This is what we're wrestling with as a culture. How can you know what's true? How can you even figure this out? How can you answer questions like, is there a God? What's right and what's wrong? How should we think about issues like abortion and transgenderism? And what should we think about what happens when we die? These kind of questions, as a culture, we're walking around in circles. We're in a blizzard. We're disoriented. We're confused. We don't know really what to think a lot of the time. Well, into this blizzard of confusion comes the message of Christmas. And the great message of Christmas is that there is a rope. There is a rope that can guide you safely through the blizzard of this life when you can't see all around you, when you're not sure which way is up and down and forward and backward. There is a rope to guide you safely to your home. That is where the message of Christmas becomes such good news. And so what I want to do this morning is I want to help you so much. I'm praying that this would really benefit you. And probably the younger you are, the more important this issue is. The younger you are, the more important it is that you get a firm understanding of what truth is, of what this rope is, of how you can be guided through life. But of course, it's not just when you're young. It's also when you're old. It's especially when you're nearing your own death. You need to be solid. You need to have something to hold on to, lest you just, in the last days of your life, be walking in circles and end up freezing to death because you didn't know which way was home. This matters to everyone. So this morning, I'm praying that God would come and he would show you the rope, that he would enable you to grip onto it, that you would not be disoriented, confused, and like so much of culture, just constantly wandering in circles. So let me develop this message in three sequential parts. First, the disorienting blizzard. Second, the guiding rope. And then finally, the journey home. First then, let's take a bunch of time to talk about the disorienting blizzard. Again, here's the way I'm using this metaphor. I'm using it to describe the confusion that arises from the fact that there's just so many viewpoints, so many different opinions on all kinds of different things that we end up getting disoriented. We're confused. We don't, like the Harvard grad, we don't know what to believe anymore. The ancient world was no different than today. So let's look at our text, and you can see that right away here in verse 1. You'll notice, of course, that John's theme is this idea, this theme of what he calls the Word. So verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. When your English translation says the Word, it's translating the Greek word which John wrote, which is the word logos. Logos. Now, I don't usually bore you with Greek words, but today we're going to talk about that a lot. We're going to break it all down because this is super, super important. So John is saying then, if you want to read this a little bit, not quite translated, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. Now, this term, logos, this was a very common word in the ancient world. I know it's not super common to you, but if you were just an average person living in the ancient world, you would immediately know what everybody was talking about. Again, like a few weeks ago, we don't know what that means, so we need to get into this ancient mindset and be able to understand what is going on here. You can begin to understand what logos means if you understand that we get our word logic from it. If something is logical, it doesn't have contradiction, it follows properly after another, there's a unity to it. Logos has some of those kind of ideas in it. The idea of logos comes from the Greek philosophers. They were all searching for the logic, if you will, the logos behind all things. So they looked out at the universe and they said, oh, there's all this stuff. There's all this kind. We talk about morality. We talk about where the universe came from. What is the logos behind it all? What's the reason? What's the ultimate reality, the ultimate thing behind everything that exists? Now, right away, you're saying, oh, that's the problem with philosophers. You know, they got their head in the clouds. I mean, all this huge thinking stuff, this is not practical. But it's so practical. The Greek philosophers wanted to understand if there's a logos, and if it is, what is the logos? Because if you can understand why something exists, then you know how to use it. Think of your smartphone, for instance. You can't really know how to use a smartphone unless you first of all know why it exists. I mean, if you've never seen one before and somehow you've lived in some part of the world, you've never even heard of this, and then someone gave a smartphone to you, you might just kind of look at it and turn it over and think maybe it's a mirror you look in, or I don't know what it is, and maybe think you could just kind of use it as a hammer to knock something down, and you're going to quickly realize that's not what it's for. You have to know why something exists if you're going to know how to actually use it. So the Greek philosophers wanted to know if there was such thing as a logos behind all things, and if there is, what is it, so that they could know how human beings ought to live. That's why they were doing it. It's very practical. All this came down to that. So not everyone in the ancient world actually believed there was a logos. Some people did, some people didn't. But if you were an educated urban person living in say, ancient Rome or something like that, or Athens, you would have fallen into one of two camps in your understanding of if there's a logos or if there is not. You would have either been part of the Stoic thinking or the Epicurean way of thinking. If you remember in Acts 17, Paul debates these two groups, the Stoics and the Epicureans. So here's what we're going to do. Just like 2 weeks ago, right now we're going to do a deep dive into some ancient ways of thinking. And this is not a history lesson. I mean, you're going to learn some history here. But what I'm doing all of this for is so that you're going to understand what logos is, so that when we come to John 1, you're going to go, oh, now I see it in a way I never saw it before. So track with me through this as to what Stoics believed and what Epicureans believe, because I'm going to show you it has everything to do with what you and I believe and this whole entire issue of truth. First then, the Stoics. When the Stoics looked at the universe, they saw harmony and order. They saw logic. They saw logos, in other words. So they believed that logos was kind of like a divine force that stood behind everything in the universe, that brought life to everything in the universe. So if you're alive, you have the seed of logos within you. Logos is not God in the sense of the way we use the word, maybe a personal God. Logos is an impersonal force or life force or something like that. Probably the best way for us to understand that today is to think about the big cultural phenomenon this last week, which was the release of Star Wars. Oh, yes, some of you even got it, right? All right. So Star Wars just put out another new movie. I'm thinking this is not going to end for 50 years now that Disney has the rights to Star Wars. Every Christmas it's going to be, okay, we're on Star Wars 36 now. That's what it's going to be. So Star Wars came out this past week, and in Star Wars, of course, in the Star Wars world, it is the Force that is the Logos, right? The Force stands behind the whole universe. The Force runs through the universe. It's the Force that gives life to everything and sustains everything. And then, of course, the Force has the light side and the dark side to it. The Force is not a personal God that you can know. The Force is not a personal God that you would worship, per se. The Force is an impersonal thing, but it gives life and light to everything. So this is what the Stoics believe. That's our modern example of it. The Stoics believe there is such thing as logos. You can't know logos personally, but there is logos, and you need to get your life in line with logos. Now, it's the same thing for us today. It's not just Star Wars. Let me put it to you this way. I think I've said to you before, and you've heard studies on this, that people here on the west coast of British Columbia are the least likely to be religious in all of North America. Now, you might conclude from that that all people on the west coast are atheists, but you'd be very wrong. In fact, there are not that many atheists. The atheism is a very small segment of belief systems within the west, on the west coast of Canada. If you ask people, do you believe in God? The vast majority are going to say, yes, I believe in God. Now, you might think, well, that's very encouraging. But then you got to ask the follow-up question. Here's where everything changes. When pollsters ask people, okay, you believe in God, what do you think God is like? The vast majority of people will answer, I believe in an impersonal God. I believe there is a life force or something. It's a divine force behind everything that's existed. Yes, it probably created the universe. It's kind of in everything. So it's in the trees, this life force. It's in us, everything that's alive. And so kind of all New Age teaching, all this kind of teaching comes out of that idea. Deepak Chopra, Oprah, these are all kind of people would say, of course there's a spiritual realm. Of course there's kind of this higher power, this divine reality above and beyond all things that is also in all things, right? So this is what we think here on the West Coast. Most people believe in the idea of logos. That is, in the idea of an ultimate reality above all things, through all things, in all things. This ultimate reality which gives life to everything. But of course, since logos is impersonal, people will say, This God that I believe in would never tell me how to live. You know, this God doesn't care about who I have sex with or who I don't or how I spend my money. That's totally irrelevant to the discussion. It's an impersonal God that people believe in. Okay, that's the Stoics. Just like not everyone today believes in the existence of God, so also in the ancient world, not everyone believed in the idea of logos. And so there was this group produced by this man named called Epicurus. And Epicurus, the Epicureans, they followed his way of thinking. And the Epicureans are what we would call today a naturalist. They wouldn't have been called atheists. They would have just been naturalists. So a naturalist is somebody who, when they look out at the material universe, says, this is all there is. All that exists is what you can see with your senses and what you can perceive. There is no spiritual world above and beyond the natural world. There is only the natural universe. And so, of course, today that's what we would call atheism. So guys like Richard Dawkins, the most famous atheist of our day, he would have been right in line with Epicurus. Epicurus, one of his great goals was to rid humanity of the darkness and superstition of religion. And Richard Dawkins follows in the exact same path. So listen to Richard Dawkins. He says, there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for being. So what I appreciate about that quote is it's being honest. He's saying there is no logos. There is no ultimate reality above the physical universe. And since there is nothing like that, there is no such thing as meaning. There is no direction to the universe. And we have to accept this fact. That's what Dawkins is saying. There's a lot of implications if you're an Epicurean or if you are an atheist. One of them, of course, is that the future is a very bleak thing. No matter how much humanity may get better and better, no matter how much we may save the planet, so to speak, from environmental collapse, in the end, of course, the sun's going to burn out and everything's going to die. That's what you have to believe if there is no God and there is no logos behind the universe. That's where everything is going. And so this is another area where in our culture today, there's just this kind of constant anxiety about the future. Because we've been raised in a culture where, by and large, people are saying there's no direction for culture. You know, the world's not being guided by some hand to go somewhere. And so there's anxiety about the future. One of the ways that I see this is among the most popular genre of teen literature today. For the last few years, the most popular genre amongst teen books is what we call dystopian novels. Dystopian novels. So Hunger Games is a dystopian novel. The Divergent series is a dystopian series. What do we mean by that? Well, it's the opposite of utopian. Utopia is where you look into the future and you see everything coming together into an ideal world and everything is great in the end. That's utopia. Dystopia is the opposite. A dystopian novel looks into the future and sees a great apocalypse. It sees some great problem where, you know, 3/4 of the human race is wiped out by, I don't know, zombies or by some virus or whatever, aliens. And so now there's only a handful of humanity left and they're trying to do their best to hold on to that. So why are teens so interested in dystopian novels? Why is that the most popular genre in the last few years? Maclean's magazine ran an article asking that question, and they said that the teenagers today resonate with these books because they have grown up in an era of economic uncertainty, conspiracy theories, nuclear threat, and the fear of environmental collapse. So if you've been raised in a culture where you've been taught there is no such thing as logos, there is no hand that is guiding the human race as it goes along, and eventually the environment is going to collapse, then of course what's going to resonate with you most is a future that is bleak, a future where humanity is trying to hold on for everything that they have after some great apocalypse. Now with all that said, the Stoics, the Epicureans, let's bring this to today. Just like in the ancient world, we face a whole pile of opinions on what is truth. It's a blizzard of opinions. Is there a God? What's going to happen in the future? What happens when we die? And into this disorienting blizzard of opinions, John begins to make the claims of Christianity. And here's his first claim. In the verse 1, he makes one simple fact, and it is this: there is a logos. There is a logos. In verse 1, in the beginning was the logos. So he's saying before there was the universe itself, there was this thing. There was ultimate reality. There was ultimate truth. There was this thing. So in light of that, the universe is not meaningless, John is saying. There's a purpose to the universe. There's a design for your life. The universe is going somewhere. There is a logos. So at this point, I'm not drawing out anything more than to simply draw a line between what we call atheism and theism. Atheism, now we're saying Christianity is not that. We are saying it's at least one thing. There is a logos. There is a higher power. There is ultimate reality. That's all we've said so far. Now, let's build on that. With all that history background, it's all going to come together now. At this point, the average person on the West Coast is just like the ancient Stoic. Even reading this first verse of the book of John, the Stoics and a person on the West Coast will say, this sounds fine to us. Okay, what you're saying so far then is there's more to the universe than just what we can see and what we can sense and feel. Okay, people say, we're on track with that. That sounds good. We could call it a force. We could call it a little g God, whatever we want to call it. We are on track with that. Really, what we said so far isn't very radical to Canadians, and it isn't very radical to Stoics. But what John says next sent a shockwave through the ancient world. What John says next sent such a shockwave through the ancient world that it completely turned it upside down. What John is about to say next took the whole way Western world thought, which was Greek thought, and just within a few years completely shifted it so that we had Christian thought for 1,500 years. What John says next changed absolutely everything, and it has everything to do with Christmas. So to feel the full force of this, let's come to this second point now, and let's talk about the guiding rope. We've talked about the disorienting blizzard. Let's talk now about the guiding rope. And if you really want to get what's going on in John 1, this is why I gave you this background. If you really want to get it, I want you to walk with me very closely now through the first few verses of John. So if you've got a Bible or you've got the handout, track with me very closely as we walk through this, okay? Let's read this through the eyes of an ancient, educated, urban, stoic, or Epicurean. Let's read it through the eyes of a West Coast person who believes in an impersonal being such as a god or a life force or whatever. Let's read it through those eyes so that we will feel the full force of what John is saying. Okay, so track with me. Verse 1. In the beginning was the Logos. Okay, stop there. The stoic says, all right, before the universe existed, there was Logos. Logos is eternal. Okay, good, good, good. We are with you, John, so far. I like this. Keep going. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God. Okay, a little strange, John, that you're seeming to make a difference between Logos and God. Aren't those kind of the same things? But maybe, John, you just need a little more clarity in your writing. But we're with you, John. Okay, continue on. And the Logos was God. Oh, good. Okay, good, says the Stoic. Good, says the person on the West Coast. I thought you were saying Logos was distinct from God, but now you've made it crystal clear. Logos is God. Okay, we're with you. We like this Christianity thing. We like what you're saying so far. Preach it, John. Okay, John continues on. Verse 2. He, that's the Logos, was in the beginning with God. Now, at this point, the Stoic says, I'm not quite sure why you said he, since Logos is a bit more of an impersonal force, but we're with you, John. Keep going. I'm interested in this Christianity thing. Keep talking. All right, verse 3. All things were made through him, that's the Logos. And without him, the Logos, was not anything made that was made. Again, the Stoic says, way to go, John. I mean, you are nailing this. This Christianity stuff, this is good. I mean, this Epicurus, how can he believe what he believes? Richard Dawkins, how can they possibly believe that the universe exists out of nothing? How can something does not arise out of nothing? So how can they possibly believe that the universe came from nothing? It makes no logical sense. So the Stoic and even many of the spiritual West Coast people are saying, we like this. What you're saying is there was this Logos, this divine reality that was eternal, that was there in the beginning, and it was this ultimate reality that somehow brought the universe into existence. All right, we are with that, John. We like what you're saying. John then goes on to say that this Logos brings life and light to all people. The Stoics are now cheering. I mean, West Coast people love that imagery of light. That's good stuff. He goes on to say how John the Baptist came into the world, and John said that he was not the light. He was not the Logos. He only came to bear witness to the light and to the Logos. And I mean, everyone's like, John's getting a standing ovation now. This is great. Of course, John the Baptist is not the Logos. That's just ridiculous. So keep going, John. The whole ancient world is about to convert to Christianity. This stuff sounds so good. And then John drops the bomb. What John says next scandalizes the ancient world, and it still scandalizes the world today. Look at verse 14. The Logos became flesh. The Stoic kind of rereads the verse. What? Did I read that correctly? The divine Logos became a man? That's ridiculous. And then John continues on. And the Logos dwelt among us. John, are you mad? You think that ultimate reality, like the thing behind all things, that which gave the universe birth, you're saying ultimate reality lived as a man among us? Are you crazy? What are you talking about, John? And then John continues on. He's not done. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. So at this point, the Stoic is either just sitting there in dumbstruck silence, trying to comprehend how Logos could possibly become a man, or the Stoic is taking John's letter and is ripping up the pages and saying, John, you not only claim that Logos became a man, you're saying you saw the glory of the Logos? You're saying that truth itself took on human flesh and that you've seen the glory of ultimate truth? That's exactly what John's saying. John is saying nothing less than that the man Jesus, who was born of the Virgin Mary, is the Logos. Jesus, the man who lived among us on this planet, is none other than ultimate reality in a human body, on human flesh, taking on a human nature. Jesus, this historical man, is the Logos. Now, let me take everything we've said, let's recap this argument and build it up, because I really, really want you to get this. It's going to become super practical in a moment. Contrary to atheism, Christianity begins with the claim that there is a Logos. There is truth behind all that exists. There is purpose. There is design, which means there's meaning for your life and for my life. Christianity then goes a step further and builds on that and says, Logos is a personal being called God, not an impersonal force. That's very clear if you look at the end of verse 1 and then verse 2. Look at it again. It says the Logos was God. Okay, now what's God like? He, personal pronoun, not it. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So Logos is a personal being, not an impersonal force. And then Christianity puts one more layer on top of that, and it begins to say, okay, Logos also became flesh and dwelt among us. In other words, ultimate reality became a man. Ultimate truth became a man. Ultimate truth visited our planet 2,000 years ago. Logos walked among us. Logos is none other than Jesus, the boy, the baby that was born to the Virgin Mary. And now here's the big clincher. All that, those three things, have now built up to this great practical point. This was the goal of everything I've said so far. We can know truth because Jesus, Logos in human flesh, has revealed it to us. We can know truth because Jesus, who is Logos in human flesh, has revealed it to us. Jesus, if he truly is who John is saying he is, when he speaks, you are listening to the very word of the truth speak. When you are listening to Jesus teach, you are listening to ultimate truth itself speak. When Jesus comes and acts, you are watching ultimate reality act. You are watching God himself revealing himself to us through his life and through his teachings. He teaches us about God. He teaches us about our sin, about our need for a Savior, about our sexuality, about how we should spend our money. He comes and he teaches us all of these things. So here's the big application. This means there is a rope. Into this blizzard, this whiteout of so many opinions and questions that we have, the message of Christianity is there is a rope. There is something which, if you grab onto it, can guide you safely through the blizzard of this life. No, let's correct that sentence. Not something, someone. The rope is a person. So to change the metaphor then, as you're walking through the blizzard of life, what you need to do is grab on to ultimate truth himself, who is Jesus. Grab onto him and say, I'll walk behind you. I'll walk in your footsteps. You just guide me. I can't see where I'm going. I'm unsure of so many things, but you are the truth. And so I will grab onto you. I will listen to you, and I will walk where you tell me to go. Let me see if I can say all of this again, but in a different way, just to really make this point. In Vancouver, there's a very liberal church, and it used to always put church signs up, you know, these church sign things, and sometimes those are funny. They go around the internet about church signs they put up. This church I always enjoyed walking by because it was just one heresy after another. And so I would always get an interesting moment. I get to reflect on something that was up on the church sign. I actually stopped one time, and I saw the guy putting the sign up, and I said, where do you get these quotes from? I was so curious. And he said, well, we just get them off the internet. We just go and look up spiritual quotes, and we put them up. I was like, that makes a lot of sense. I get it now. Anyways, one day I'm driving by, and I look, and I see this sign. And here's what it said. It said, the universe is the primary revelation of the divine. The universe is the primary revelation of the divine. What do you think about that? So it's saying, if you want to know who the divine is, the primary way you understand that is look out at the universe. My response to that was I was so frustrated that an apparently Christian church would put this sign up. I actually just was I was by myself, but I just went, ah! Like as I was driving by, because I was just couldn't believe an apparently Christian church would put up that sign. Now, what's the problem with that? Do we believe that the universe reveals God? Do we believe that as Christians? That was a little tentative. You're worried, right? Of course we do. Yep, Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare, proclaim, reveal the glory of God. Of course the universe reveals God. If the sign had said the universe is a revelation of the divine, I would have cheered and I would have honked my horn and I just went by and just gave him a big thumbs up. Way to go, boys. That's not what the sign says. There's one word in that sign that takes it from what would be supposed Christian teaching and actually makes it into anti-Christian, New Age spiritualist teaching. It's the word primary. Or at best, it would just be Old Testament. No, that's not even true. Old Testament, that would not even work. Forget I said that. Sometimes I think of things on the spot and I'm like, no, that doesn't even work either. What the message of Christmas is that the universe is a revelation of the divine, but since Logos became flesh, the sign should say, Jesus is the primary revelation of the divine. You get the distinction? Do you want to know who God is? Do you want to know what truth is? Here's how you can figure it out. One, yes, you can look at the universe and you can understand that God is a creator, that he is wise, that he is powerful. You can learn much from looking at the universe. But if you really want to know truth, the message of the Bible is that God has revealed himself to us, not just through the universe, but he has done it supremely through his Son. For the Son is the very image of the invisible God. The Son is the exact representation of his being. So when you look upon the Son of God, you look upon God himself, you look upon ultimate reality, you look upon ultimate truth. So, of course, right here is where when I'm talking with people, they say, this is where the conversation goes. They'll say, isn't that really arrogant, though, to claim that you guys know the truth? Like, as Christians, you're saying you know the truth and that, maybe other people don't and things like that. It's usually clarified. And I say, I'm not saying that everything everyone else believes is wrong. I'm not saying that at all. But I am claiming, yes, I am claiming to know the truth about who God is and about numerous other things. And no, I don't think that's arrogant, and here's why. Here's the clarifying thing I always try to say to people. I say, Christians do not believe that we know the truth because we are smarter than everyone else. We do not claim to know the truth because we are more enlightened than everyone else. Oh, no, no, no. We claim to know the truth because God has chosen to reveal it to us. And that's the only way. And so how can I ever understand truth? I can't. I have a peon of a mind. I can't understand this, but God in his grace has chosen to reveal himself to us. That's how we can know truth, is because God has shown himself, and the supreme way that he's done that is through his Son, Jesus Christ, who is Logos in human flesh. So that's the good news of Christmas. The good news of Christmas is there's a rope to guide you through this life. Yes, this life is a blizzard. You often don't know the answers to things, but there is a rope, but it's not a rope. It's a person. And if you grab onto the person, if you listen to the person, if you follow in the footsteps of the person, he will guide you safely home. That's the message of Christmas. So let's take all that then and wrap it up into the application, which is the final thing I want to talk about. We've talked about the disorienting blizzard, the guiding rope, now the journey home. It doesn't do any good to talk about, you know, grabbing hold of a rope in a blizzard to guide you safely home if you don't actually go and grab hold of the rope. Who cares if there's a rope halfway across the yard, if you're walking around in circles over here knowing there's a rope, but you're not even looking for it? You have to go grab hold of the rope. And in the exact same way, Jesus, if he really is, as the Bible claims he is, Logos in human flesh, you have to grab hold of him. You can't just have this like, okay, that sounds interesting, Jesus has the truth. You got to grab hold of him. John writes his letter so that you will grab hold of Jesus. In his words, so that you will believe in him. You will entrust yourself to him. That's why John writes this book, to convince you to do that, to shape your whole life around Jesus. If you have your Bibles, I don't have this one written down for you, but I think it's going to be on the screen. At the end of his book, John tells us why he writes his book. Here's what he says. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written, that is, I wrote my book, why? So that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. You may have life. So John has written all that he's written so that you will not die, so that you will not freeze to death going around in circles, not knowing which way is left or right. He's written it that you might have that rope, that you might be guided safely home, that you might know life. For to come to Jesus is to come to life. So everything then builds up to this one culminating point this morning. Here's the big question for you and for me. Who for you decides what is true? Who or what for you decides what is true? And the answer for most people living on the West Coast is, I do. I decide what I will believe to be true. I decide how I will live my life. Most people probably endorse the postcard I once saw. It had a saying which was attributed to Buddha. Who knows, because it's not a postcard, but I'll give it to you. It said, believe nothing, no matter where you read it or who has said it, not even if I have said it, unless it agrees with your own reason and your own common sense. You know, I said that we as Christians often get accused of being arrogant to claim to know the truth, but I think this cuts both ways. Is it not quite a degree of arrogance to say that you as a human being can know what is true without any revelation from God? That you know what's right and wrong, you can answer all these questions. I think there needs to be a great deal more humility here, for when I even just think about myself, I think, I am not that smart. I hardly even understand my own mind half the time. I don't even know why I think the things that I do half the time. I can't even grasp basic concepts in life. My kids are, you know, they're all in French immersion. You know, after kindergarten, I have no idea what they're talking about anymore. You know, and then I look at their math problems and like in grade 8 now, and I'm like, oh, I'm glad I'm done with that. Like, I don't understand half the most basic things in life. And then I don't understand my own family, and they're like my blood, right? My own wife, she doesn't make sense sometimes to me. She probably does, but she makes sense to herself, but not to me. So maybe it's just me who's not really smart. Maybe you're a lot better than that. But maybe a little humility would be in order here. And that's just on a small level. How about the fact that you and I are nothing more than tiny, tiny, tiny little beings living on a tiny, tiny little planet in the vastness of the universe, where there are black holes and exploding stars and all of these type of things, black holes which we cannot even really comprehend what goes on inside of them. despite all that's going on, are we really going to say, I have all knowledge. I will decide what is true. I will decide all these things. Shouldn't a little bit of humility be in order? I would suggest to you that the reason why people on the West Coast, the reason why we on the West Coast want to believe in an impersonal God is so that we can maintain control. I would suggest this to you. You ponder on this. People don't like anyone else telling them what to do, even God. So I think this is why people love this idea of a personal, impersonal God like the Force in Star Wars. Because listen, an impersonal force will never contradict you. An impersonal force will never say, you're not loving your wife correctly. An impersonal force will never say, you need to think about you're giving your money away like this and not living for yourself like this. An impersonal force will never do that. So what is the God that you worship really like? If the God that you worship never contradicts you, then all that God really is a projection of your own mind. If there is truly a God, which the Bible says there is, then that God may at times contradict you, not because he's out to get you, but because he wants to do things in your lives. Isn't it the reason why we don't really want a personal God is because then we'd have to give up control? Many people have said this. C.S. Lewis, for instance, before he became a Christian, said he did not want to believe in a personal God because, quote, I had always wanted above all things not to be interfered with. Listen, though, if God is personal, then he will speak truth to you. That's why when Jesus came, he didn't say, like the saying attributed to Buddha, he would have said, believe nothing, no matter where you read it or who has said it, unless I have said it. And he would say to you, I am not just the way, I am the truth. Listen to me. Now, this is right where it hits our hearts because we think, oh man, that means giving up control. I don't know if I want to do what Jesus says. It's kind of scary to give up control of your life. What if he contradicts you? What if he says you have to do something else? But listen, this is where the good news of Christmas comes in as well. For the message of Christmas is that Jesus is not just full of truth. He's not just going to hammer you with truth. He's also full of grace. This is the one who has come for you, the one who wants to bring you life. Jesus said, I have come that you may have life and have it to the full. The God of the universe, ultimate reality, who became incarnate in Jesus, the Son of God, became a man, that God says, I am for you. I have come to bring you life. I have come to take you through that blizzard. I have come in order that you may have life and have it to the full. The message of Christmas is that the Son of God became the Son of Man in order that he might guide you safely through the blizzard of this life to bring you home to the Father's house where the fire is roaring and where the atmosphere is charged with eternal joy and the feast is prepared. That's the kind of God he is. He says, I've come that you may have life. But what you got to do is you got to surrender control. You got to say, okay, I'm going to stop being my own God, my own arbiter of truth. I am going to bow the knee to you, Jesus. For Jesus' message was, you got to come and have a Savior. That's the first thing you need. And Jesus has come to save us. So I ask you today, have you come before Jesus and said, Jesus, would you rescue me? Would you save me? I'm giving up my life to you. I want to follow you. I want to read the Bible. I want to learn what you said. I want to submit all of my life underneath you, for I believe that you're the one who knows the way. You know the way home. I don't. I'm wandering around in circles. I'm totally confused. I believe you know the way. And then have you begun to live that way? If you become a Christian, have you said, okay, Jesus is Logos in human flesh. I got to read the scriptures. I got to see what he says. I got to make sure my whole life is lining up with this. Since Jesus is Logos in human flesh, you can trust him. Since Jesus gave his life for sinners upon the cross, you can trust that he has your best interest at heart. So the big question is, who decides truth for you? Let's pray. We praise you, O God, that you did not leave us in the darkness, You do not leave us wandering in circles, but in your grace, you sent your Son into this world. You sent him in part to show us the truth, to reveal truth to us. And so, Father, right now, we would bow before you. Each of us in our own hearts right now would say, you are God. We are not. You are truth. We want to come in line with you. Teach us, O God, what it means to live with Christ as our Savior, Christ as the one who guides us, Christ as the one who teaches us truth. Enable us to see your goodness, for Father, we confess, we often do not truly believe that you have our best interests at heart. Help us to believe that Christ is the one who brings us life. May this Christmas season, Father, may you work this in all our hearts, that our lives would line up with you, that we'd get rid of all things that are not in line with you, that we would safely be brought home. Pray this in your name.